Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, what if your behavior is not caused by your psychology, but by parasites? But first, what might be next in U.S. politics in light of the latest developments? Last week, we discussed where the U.S. is heading under the Trump presidency and whether it might begin to resemble authoritarian states. In light of the latest revelations in the special investigation by Robert Mueller, we continue our conversation with our experts. We asked our guests what the consequences might be if the investigation comes to a head. With us are three experts. Louis Michael Seidman is professor of constitutional law at Georgetown University Law Center in Washington, D.C. He is the author of On Constitutional Disobedience, Silence and Freedom, Constitutional Law, Equal Protection of the Laws, and Our Unsettled Constitution, A New Defense of Constitutionalism and Judicial Review. Sanford Levinson is chair in law at the University of Texas Law School and a professor in the Department of Government at the University of Texas. He is the author of Constitutional Faith, Our Undemocratic Constitution, Where the Constitution Goes Wrong and How We the People Can Correct It, and Framed, America's 51 Constitutions and the Crisis of Governance. Mark Peterson also joins us. He's a professor of public policy, political science, and law at UCLA. His books include Legislating Together, the White House and Capitol Hill, From Eisenhower to Reagan, Institutions of American Democracy, the Executive Branch, and Institutions of American Democracy, A Republic Divided. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have the three of you. We have seen some move in the Mueller investigation. Steve Bannon has been subpoenaed. He's agreed to cooperate. And that doesn't get much closer, I think, to President Trump. So we haven't seen yet what the result of that is. And I know what we would say now would be pure speculation, but perhaps maybe the first thing to ask is, what do you see as the possible scenarios? Sandy Levinson.
I mean, the only honest answer I could give is, I don't know. To put it mildly, Donald Trump's mind is hard to read. First of all, he might actually believe what he says. That is, that there's no evidence of collusion with Russia. And that, of course, is the focus of the Mueller investigation. One really has no idea to what extent Mueller and his team have access to Trump's tax returns and might try to get him on money laundering or other sorts of financial dealings. But Trump may genuinely believe that he has nothing to worry about. He may also believe that when push comes to shove, he can simply pardon everybody, including himself. And the pardoning power is the constitutional wild card. That is, the Constitution clearly assigns the power to pardon. It places no limits within the text itself. So could Trump pardon Jared? I think the answer is clearly yes. Could that count as an impeachable offense? My inclination would be to answer yes. But there are many, many lawyers who would say no. Alan Dershowitz, I think, would say if the president is exercising a legal power, then it simply couldn't become the basis for impeachment. There are a number of ways in which the Constitution turns on itself, and the pardoning power is in many ways one of the most interesting. If you read the debates from 1787-88, about ratification of the Constitution, you find more discussion of the pardoning power than you do of Congress's power under the Commerce Clause, which is what we're obsessed about today. And some of the opponents of the Constitution said the president will ally with anti-constitutionalist agents who will try to tyrannize us, and then he will pardon them, his cabal. When I read these for the first time, probably 20 or 30 years ago, I thought this was sheer paranoia. Today, it doesn't seem quite so paranoid. It's a genuine problem posed within the Constitution itself. And what are the limits? I mean, we're going to have the same discussion in a way about the president's powers, commander-in-chief. Are we willing to accept tyrannical or indeed crazy decisions on the part of the president because, quote, good lawyers, unquote, would say that's just what the Constitution authorizes?
Mark Peterson, do you want to respond?
Yes. Well, first of all, I want to agree profoundly with my colleagues here that this is an extraordinarily unique period and situation. So no one is going to be able to offer any serious prediction in a knowing way about what will transpire. And I think we all share the fear that given some of the unique circumstances right now, that we're looking at a window of opportunity or window of scare, of fear about pathways that we would not have imagined we'd be talking about a couple of decades ago. I do think, however, that one of the things about the American political system, if President Trump were to fire Mueller, that would, in a sense, be the end of normal political business, normal congressional deliberation and business. It would have a kind of impact, maybe even a broader impact than when President Nixon ordered the firing of Archibald Cox. That became then the entire experience of the country for a period of time. And the other thing to note is the context, and this is where maybe I have a naive level of faith, but one of the things that I think is important to underscore, just as I am shocked at the level of support someone like President Trump can still manage to have among the public, given his behavior and how he talks and describes things. At the same time, we have to remember this president has the lowest presidential approval in the first year of any president in the history of recording public support or opposition to the president. We have to remember the day after this man was inaugurated, in somewhere between 350 and 400 cities across the United States, 3 to 4 million people marched in opposition. Just imagine, that's the day after the inauguration, before we even can be absolutely certain what this person would be like coming into office. Imagine what would happen in the streets and in civil society and in general discourse in our country if the president were to engage in activities that would lead many people to really be concerned that we were on the brink. And I think there would be a capacity on the part of the Democrats to be in opposition. I think there'd be some Republicans at that point who would start being more concerned about the institutional integrity of the government than moving a particular conservative agenda.
So this is Mike. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, Mike Seidman.
Thank you. I agree with a lot of what you've said, Mark. And so the answer to the initial question, I think the reason why Trump has not fired Mueller is because he does realize that it would have those consequences, and so he wants to avoid it. But it may be that we get to a point where he can't avoid it, where it is a choice of undergoing those consequences or having his presidency destroyed. And then I don't really have much doubt as to what he would do. With regard to the So I also agree that the big hope here is in popular mobilization and political opposition, and I agree it might well be quite powerful. But the Nixon analogy actually makes me somewhat uneasy because there are important differences between the situation in 1974 and the situation now. And so let me just list three of them. One is that in 1974, the Democrats were in control of both houses of Congress and could utilize that control to oppose Nixon. And the Supreme Court was less obviously politically aligned than it is now. A second difference is that even the Republicans in Congress were not as ideologically unified and not as willing to kowtow to Richard Nixon as almost all the Republicans in Congress are ready to kowtow to Donald Trump. And so that's why I do think it a lot is going to turn on whether the Republicans change their mind about that. And then a third thing is that, and I think Sandy pointed this out last time, for all of his faults, Richard Nixon was actually something of a constitutionalist. So he, when the Supreme Court told him that he had to turn over the tapes, he turned them over. I don't think there's any reason to expect Donald Trump to behave in the same way. So those are things that give me pause and keep me up at night.
And I think there's one other. Go ahead, Sandy. Sandy Levinson.
I think that what Trump and his minions have decided to do, and it's quite a smart strategy, is to attack the integrity of Mueller and to try to paint him as a partisan, which he isn't. But I think they have the Fox television network totally and utterly behind them. They have the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal basically behind them, and some of their columnists for the journal. And so the proper analogy is actually Ken Starr, because although I increasingly believe that Bill Clinton perhaps should have been impeached, that we lost something important in his escaping impeachment. One of the reasons he did escape is because Ken Starr was successfully and I think accurately portrayed as a right-wing Republican who also, frankly, was kind of driven crazy by the whole sexual overlay of what Clinton had done. And so when Starr wrote his Starr report, everybody focused on the salacious stuff and simply took this as further evidence that he had gone crazy and was part of what Hillary Clinton correctly called the vast right-wing conspiracy. And I think Trump is taking his place from that playbook. And so what we won't know until it happens is whether a solid majority of the country, including a significant number of Republicans, would say, no, Robert Mueller really is above politics. He really is behaving like an honorable man, and we have to take him fully seriously, or whether he would, in effect, be turned into a Ken Starr figure that would legitimate Republicans rallying around their guy.
This is Mark Peterson. If I could just jump in, I think those points are very well taken, and with a little bit of nuance around the edges. The one nuance is to recognize that Bill Clinton was indeed impeached. This wasn't convicted in the Senate.
Yes, right.
Wasn't convicted. But the point is also well taken that that only happened because of the nature of the partisan division of government at the time. If the Democrats had been in majority, probably he would not have been impeached in the House. The one thing I'll say is Ken Starr, of course, was a Republican and he had a Republican roots, and going after a Democratic president and going after, as you say, Sandy, a Democratic president on things that got the country's attention in the most salacious way. The difference with Mueller is, of course, Mueller is not a Democrat going after a Republican president. He's a Republican, former FBI director going after a Republican president, which does give him a different kind of credibility. And other than one particular strand of the Steele report, the charges here are not salacious. The charges here really go to the heart of national security and the integrity of the American democratic system. And that will be a harder, I'm sure there will be every effort to try to play the same playbook, but it will be a harder play to make for Republicans writ large in this situation compared to the Ken and star situation.
Mike Seidman.
I think what Mark says is right. I would just add a little nuance to that, and that is that the situation we're in now is that there are Republicans and there are Republicans. And Mueller is the kind of Republican who Trump supporters don't think of as a real Republican. So, he's part of the establishment.
Right. The deep state, as they call it.
Right.
As if there's a left-wing conspiracy there. Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're discussing the legal and political factors that will shape the Trump presidency. Mark Peterson, this is to you. Those of us who've studied the governmental process, there is a lot of work about what you would call the bureaucratic power. There is power in the bureaucracy, but that has been now turned into, you know, something sinister in terms of the framing of it. So it's, as a political scientist, I think about bureaucracies having sometimes more power than they should, but this is the extreme framing of that. Mark Peterson.
Well, here again, we have another part of the what's so unusual about this period. The bureaucracy today, more President Trump, more than any previous president that I'm aware of, has been able to eviscerate a lot of the solidity of the bureaucracy and its capacity to, in some sense, stand as an appropriate check in the constitutional system. One, he's done that by simply making it hard for a lot of bureaucrats to do their jobs, which ultimately is to implement and fulfill the obligations of statutes as enacted by Congress. And the other is to deny many bureaucratic agencies any form of real leadership by not filling the important, more senior political appointed positions require Senate confirmation. And so, the bureaucracy is a big thing. Most of the controversies are about specific areas like the Environmental Protection Agency and some parts of the Agriculture Department and maybe a little bit of the FDA, and then you throw in the State Department, of course. But we're in an unusual time in which it's hard to really know what role the bureaucracy is playing other than kind of keeping the trains on the rail in most areas most of the time. There is certainly not a deep state element that is in any position to launch or maintain a conspiracy against the president. But interestingly, one way or another, through either stumbling in the dark reaches of his mind or through advice, Donald Trump, more than past presidents, has found a way to really stick it in the eye of the bureaucrats.
I suspect that was, you know, part of the organizing prowess and framing prowess of people like Steve Bannon and the likes of him that are throughout the media now. I want to change directions just a little bit, because one of the things, Mark Peterson, that you talked about is about how divided we are as a country now. And the, you know, political science scholars all say this is the most polarized we've been since, you know, Civil War. And Sandy, you said that as well. And I wonder now, in the context of popular opposition, which a lot of us have talked about here, well, maybe there needs to be a really strong popular opposition. But when you stop and you think about the polarization and that one side tends to be armed, that could also be a dangerous proposition. Mark Peterson?
Well, that's an interesting and provocative question. Although one side, in a way, tends to be armed, I don't think that large a percentage of them imagine themselves marching in the streets with their AR-15s and imitating the Minutemen of 1776. But it certainly is the case. Here, I think, is what is really most, in some ways to me, most profoundly frightening, because it is front and center, and it doesn't require us to play out scenarios that we can't possibly predict. And that is, President Trump has managed to activate a much more significant portion of the public than I thought existed to relish his sense of simply kind of revolutionarily disruption of the American civic society, and to bring to the fore and to normalize a way of thinking about other people, a way of thinking about one's opponents, a way of articulating political positions that is would have been beyond the pale in not too recent memory. And that I worry about, that coarsening in a most underscored way of American politics, and then putting that in the context of the deep divisions in the society. We know from the Pew Research Center, for instance, that upwards of 35 to 40% of Republicans think that Democrats are a danger to the future of the country, and a similar percentage of Democrats think Republicans are a danger to the future of the Republic. That cannot be good. And as you say, if it turns into direct confrontation of some kind, and it may be just only at the margins, but certainly in a way that would be frighteningly violent and overt, that could really change the complexion of American politics in ways that Mike's been talking about.
And what made me think of this as well is what happened in Virginia.
Yes, of course. And, but again, part of what happened in Virginia and then part of the president's response to what happened in Virginia is part of what has continued to activate a resistance movement, an effort to mobilize, as there will be more demonstrations this coming weekend. And these little nuggets like Emily's List getting 20,000 requests for information about running for office, whereas in a previous election cycle, I think was about 2,000 requests. There is a counter mobilization that may in fact be a springboard for a much more flourishing civic engagement than we've had in a very long time.
Sandy Levinson.
I think all of us agree, quoting the great Yogi Berra, that it's hard to make predictions, especially about the future. And so much could happen based on contingent events. We've not really talked about the possibility of an international crisis, which traditionally has been used by presidents to enhance their authority and authoritarianism. One could speak in this context of Lincoln, of Woodrow Wilson, of Roosevelt, of Kennedy, of Johnson, you know, all of the presidents who have gotten into wars, successful or unsuccessful. And you know, as I say, that is what scares me most. Mike has referred to Republicans being of a kind of different breed today. I think that's right, that Jeff Flake, who's the most outspoken Republican, is also notable for just throwing in the towel and not running for re-election. So now we await somebody from within the Republican Party who's really willing actively to go against Trumpism. It might be John Kasich in 2020. But let me say one other thing that I really don't like about the Constitution, and we're stuck with it, that if Donald Trump isn't impeached or thrown out because of the 25th Amendment or doesn't die, he will be president until 2020 because we don't have within the American system a possibility of a vote of no confidence or what California has. And I'd be interested to hear what Mark has to say, because for me, it's a feature of the California Constitution. For a lot of Californians, it's a bug. That is the possibility of a recall election. That the Constitution entrenches a president for 4 years, and we feel stuck. So Mike talks legitimately about how the 2018 elections could be of historic importance, but let's take the best case. Democrats get both the House and the Senate. Well, maybe they'll try to impeach him, but as we've all of us agree, impeachment wouldn't work, even if you get technical impeachment in the House. You're not going to get it a conviction in the Senate unless you have a decent number of Republicans deciding to impeach their guy and almost certainly give up any hope of winning the White House in 2020. And so you would have this ruse, egomaniacal loser in the White House for two more years. And that would not be a good thing. A better political system would give us a way of firing the president, but we don't have it. And what most frustrates me, and I think it was Mark before who detected the constant tone of frustration in my voice, is that we're simply not willing to have a serious national conversation about the degree to which the Constitution itself contributes to our malaise. And we don't feel able to work around it. One last point. We had a conversation a few minutes ago about extra constitutional activity, the importance of staying within the Constitution. Well, from my perspective, one of the worst features of the Constitution is the one that gives Wyoming and California equal voting power in the Senate. It's absolutely entrenched. There's basically no way of getting rid of it within the existing constitutional system. So, you know, one response, say, well, you know, it's indefensible, but it's not so bad. At the end of the day, it means that California really gets screwed in the tax bill because California's representation in the Senate is zilch. And so the tax bill is very, very much anti-large states, but we'll put up with it. And so at what point will we ever have a serious discussion of the way that the Constitution in a number of ways contributes to frustration, gridlock, ungovernability, the possibility of reckless military action, independently of kind of the more political considerations that we more easily talk about, like the present status of the Republican Party.
This is Mike Seidman. So, Sandy, as you know, I share a lot of your views about maybe virtually all your views about the deficiencies in the Constitution. And some of it, like Wyoming and California, is indeed so entrenched that it's almost impossible to change. But I actually don't think that the possibility of firing the president is one of the things that is that deeply entrenched. We do have a mechanism for doing that, and that is impeachment. And the language of the Constitution regarding impeachment is notoriously ambiguous and open-ended. It's true that we have a tradition of requiring a relatively high standard for that, but traditions change, and this one could change. And in that regard, just to be optimistic for a moment, I do really take the force of Mark's point about mobilization of anti-Trump forces. It's really been extraordinary what's happened in the last 6 months. And exactly for that reason, again, I think we don't know for sure what the landscape is going to look like in 2019. With a substantial enough electoral victory by the anti-Trump people, one could, I think, imagine Republicans in the Senate being sufficiently cowed to actually vote to remove the president. I think that's
Let me
something
just
there's support
in.
For now, but there could be support for it then. Just one other point. About the what Mark said about our political divisions It seems to me, and now to be a little more pessimistic, one of the things that makes those divisions especially dangerous and intractable, the divisions today, I think, are not primarily about issues of policy. If you have a policy question, politicians are very good at finding the middle and compromising and fudging things over. The division today, the divisions that affect people most viscerally, are primarily cultural. They're not about what you think or what you favor. They're about who you are. And divisions like that are not things that politicians are especially good at covering over. And that makes the situation especially volatile, I think.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're discussing the legal and political factors that will shape the Trump presidency. Sandy Levinson.
I think that one of the worst consequences of the Clinton impeachment fiasco was that it was captured by lawyers. And so that we got into all of these arcane arguments about what counted as a high crime and misdemeanor, in particular, whether perjury before a federal grand jury counted as a sufficiently high crime and misdemeanor. And my fear is that the Trumpistas, including the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal, which I think is very important in this context, would have a field day arguing that this is mere politics. The worst single moment of the Clinton impeachment, as far as I'm concerned, was when Sean Wilentz testified under oath before Congress that the impeachment of Bill Clinton would have been just like the impeachment of Andrew Johnson, that is raw politics. Well, let me tell you, and this actually touches on what we were talking about at the very end of our conversation last week. I favor the impeachment of Andrew Johnson. I think that that was central to the achievement of any sort of significant change in the defeated South, of which there wasn't enough. And what Wilentz did, though he's a very talented historian, was to present a ridiculous narrative that impeachment is a legal sort of activity and it has to meet the highest standards of law. And, you know, that wasn't available with Clinton. He argued it wasn't available with Johnson. And I assure you that Alan Dershowitz and others, unless Mueller finds the smoking gun, you know, on the tapes, there aren't any tapes with Trump that we know of. I doubt that there will be a smoking gun of the kind we had with Watergate, so that the Trumpista apologists will be able to say that it doesn't meet the standards of law. It's all political. And then you come back to the awful, awful United States Senate. And the fact is that to convict, you have to get 2/3 vote. And 1/3 of the Senate comes from states, and I'm kind of making up, I could look it up in Dr. Google, but I think you can get up to 1/3 of the Senate with something like 10 to 15% of the American population that come from overwhelmingly white, predominantly Christian, rural states that voted for Donald Trump and still constitute the basis of his support.
Sandy Levinson, can I ask you a couple of, this is again in the lawyer side, because you were concerned about lawyers taking over this. But suppose, and again, you know, I'm This is theoretical. This is a thought exercise. Suppose, first of all, obstruction of justice. I know people will say, well, you can't really, you know, unless he's impeached for that, they probably wouldn't go forward with that. Then there's the possibility of money laundering. So that is another layer. Then there's the layer of potentially being involved in organized crime. So now we've got another layer. And so the legal minds may be able to brush off one or two of them. But then the final thing, which is what Mueller is charged with, is finding out if there was this collusion with the Russian government, which many people would interpret as treason. Now, I don't know that you could get much higher crime.
Yeah. You know, I think everything you say makes sense. But if there was collusion, and I don't think it's if, I'm inclined to believe there was, I think it's Donald Jr. I think it's Jared. I doubt that Donald Trump is so stupid as to have signed anything or even said anything where he thought he would be recorded that said, oh, yeah, in return for your doing this, I will lift the sanctions. In fact, one of the things that a number of you have pointed out is that he's not made any serious efforts to lift the sanctions with Russia. So, you know, whom will he be willing to throw under a bus? Will he throw his son-in-law under a bus if it's necessary to save his presidency? I suspect he would. This is not a man for whom loyalty is a guiding lodestar. But, you know, if everything you say kind of comes true, if they get hard evidence of his doing all these things, but, you know, a Republican Congress has militantly worked to make sure that his tax returns to this moment have not been released. It takes time and genuine mobilization to create the atmosphere that you're talking about. Maybe it will happen, but I just...
You just don't see it.
It's unlikely.
Let's get final comments. Mark Peterson.
Well, I'll go back to what I think we all agree with, which is it's very hard to know what's going to transpire and that it's a time to be seriously concerned about that because we've not really confronted anything like this. One last thing I will throw in with regard to the issue of impeachment and potential conviction in the Senate. It certainly will not happen now. I would not throw it out as impossible, depending on what happens in 2018. And the other thing is, kind of interestingly, the Republicans who are really interested in a deeply conservative and socially conservative agenda have their insurance policy sitting in the office of the vice president. And if Donald Trump ultimately finally acts in a way that allows Republicans to feel released, they know by removing Donald Trump from office, they would be getting as the next president, someone whom they know and they trust and would rely on, and frankly, would probably frighten people on the left even more than Donald Trump.
Mike Seidman, final words.
This is a period of time where things have become completely unstuck and where everything is up for grabs. Certainly in my lifetime, there's no period that has been as volatile and as unsettled. I think that in the end, what is going to matter the most is, as Mark says, popular mobilization. We are in a very scary time, but the fact that it is so scary also introduces possibilities in terms of getting people to demonstrate, to go to the polls, to resist. And what's going to happen in the next year is going to turn, I think, on the extent to which that mobilization actually occurs.
Sandy Levinson.
Mark raises a really, really interesting point with Mike Pence. And I think the great what if, and I won't elaborate it, is why haven't more Republicans already figured out, especially once the tax bill is passed, that they'd be better off with Pence than with Trump. Maybe that would happen if you really do build the full bill of particulars against Trump. But I would have expected the move toward Pence already to be happening more than it is. But we'll see.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us here on the Scholar Circle. Louis Michael Seidman is professor of constitutional law at Georgetown University Law Center in Washington, D.C. He is the author of On Constitutional Disobedience, Silence and Freedom, Constitutional Law, Equal Protection of the Laws, and Our Unsettled Constitution, A New Defense of Constitutionalism and Judicial Review. Sanford Levinson is chair in law at the University of Texas Law School and a professor in the Department of Government at the University of Texas. He is the author of Constitutional Faith, Our Undemocratic Constitution, Where the Constitution Goes Wrong and How We the People Can Correct It, and Framed, America's 51 Constitutions and the Crisis of Governance. Mark Peterson is a professor of public policy, political science, and law at UCLA. His books include Legislating Together, The White House and Capitol Hill from Eisenhower to Reagan, Institutions of American Democracy, The Executive Branch, and Institutions of American Democracy, A Republic Divided. When we come back, parasites have been found to change animal behaviors, sometimes quite drastically. What does that mean for human behavior? Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. For many years, scientists and philosophers have explored how much human behavior is programmed and how much is actually free will. But now there's another factor, parasites. Parasites have been found to change animal behaviors, sometimes quite drastically. What does that mean for human behavior? Dixon DePommier is with us. He is a microbiologist, ecologist, and emeritus professor at Columbia University. His books include The Vertical Farm, Feeding the World in the 21st Century, and People, Parasites, and Plowshares, Learning from Our Body's Most Terrifying Invaders. Patrick House also joins us. He's a neuroscientist at Stanford University and the author of a key paper about how one parasite makes rodents lose their fear of cats. Welcome to the two of you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Pleasure.
Dr. DePommier, I would like to start with kind of the basics on the relationship of parasites to animal behavior. I understand parasites feed on their hosts, but sometimes they drive the behaviors of their hosts. What are some examples of this?
Absolutely. There are lots of them. In fact, there are many more to be discovered since we have only recently, I think, come to realize that nature has a series of interlocking behaviors associated with systems that tend to reinforce each other. So parasitism is a system. I don't mean to sound highfalutin on this, but everybody has a basic concept of what an ecosystem is. And if you can imagine all the plants and animals that live within a given region that could be defined as an ecosystem, virtually all those animals and plants that you can see turn out to be what we would call free-living animals or plants. If you look inside them, however, you will find that they have a collection of other organisms. Some of them are good, like the organisms that live inside our intestinal tract, for instance, the bacteria, and some of the viruses as well. But There are other organisms called parasites, which are there to take advantage of these, what we would call successful systems. So in order to do that, of course, these parasites have to be able to get from one host to another. And some of them, not all of them, but some of them alter the behavior of their hosts in order to ensure the fact that they'll be transmitted from one animal or one plant to another. And you asked me for examples. I'll just give you the one that I find the most fascinating. It involves a parasite called Spirometramansinoides. It's a tapeworm. And this tapeworm lives inside the small intestinal tract of cats and other felines like, bobcats and panthers and tigers and things of this sort. In order to catch this tapeworm, the cat or feline has to catch another animal and eat it because the parasite has a stage that lives inside the other animal. Well, it turns out that most of these other animals that cats have to catch in order to eat turn out to be either snakes or fish or amphibians. And they're usually pretty fast, especially the amphibians. They tend to jump and hide. You know, they crawl up trees and they escape from their predators, which is the cat. But this particular parasite secretes something, we think we know what it is now, something into its what we would call the host that will give the cat the parasite, in this case a frog, that makes the frog grow uncontrollably so that the frog actually gets bigger and slower and more sluggish, just like we would get if we were to eat too much and become obese. These obese frogs containing the stage that the cat needs to catch in order to get the tapeworm become very easy for the cats to catch. And so as a result, the parasite has modified the behavior of the stage of the infection that the cat needs to come in contact with in order to complete the life cycle.
I read about one parasite that actually rewires an ant's brain, its neurons, and then kind of hijacks its body.
That's correct. So that the ant becomes eaten by something else. And then that gives that something else the stage of the parasite that it needs to go on with its life. That's true for a lot of associations that you can find in nature. The more you look for them, the more you find them.
How often do you see this kind of behavior alterations in higher level animals? What about human beings?
I'm not a psychiatrist, nor am I a psychologist. I'm a parasitologist. The examples that I could give you from nature's enormous volumes of stories along these lines is the one that I think maybe Patrick House could be better to explain with regards to, I believe you're referring to Toxoplasma gondii, which is a protozoan parasite. And in fact, it's probably the most widely distributed infectious agent on the planet. Not only does it infect all mammals, but it infects most of the cells inside of most mammals. So it's almost a universal parasite. John Boothroyd, who also works at Stanford, he almost is convinced that this, in many cases, is not a parasite, but rather is a symbiont.
And it's rather a what? That, I'm sorry, say that again?
A symbiont.
A symbiont.
That actually helps in some ways to stimulate the immune system and to keep the organisms alive long enough to allow these parasites to be transmitted to other animals over long distances. That becomes a strategy. I mean, a parasite might want to keep its host alive for a long time in order to move away from the source of infection so that other animals can also become infected. So we have these strategies that parasites have evolved as well.
Patrick House, let's bring you in. You have been studying this particular parasite, and one of your findings pertains to how it changes the behavior of rats and makes them more vulnerable to their predators, cats. What happens?
One of the interesting things is that if you actually look at this broad range of parasites that manipulate their host behavior, you actually find most of them in insects. So it'll change the behavior of maybe an ant or maybe a cricket. There are examples of these particular ones. Also, I believe a cockroach. There's one wasp that will actually inject something into a cockroach. But if you think about it on the level of complexity, these are actually rather simple organisms, insects. I mean, they don't have brains per se as we define them. And what I think makes this particular Toxoplasma parasite interesting is that actually it's one of very few things, if not the only thing that we know of, that actually gets into mammalian brains, sits there, and doesn't actually end up killing the host. This idea that the parasite may actually be sitting in the brain for years, months, kind of across the vast majority of the host's life is interesting, because then you can ask, well, what if any, possible changes in behavior are there? Because, you know, the brain is the seat of a lot of these, of what we consider to be will. So this particular parasite has to get and can only sexually reproduce. And by sexually, I mean it can only combine its genes around inside the cat. So again, we have cat as an origin for one of the most interesting things in kind of this manipulation hypothesis for parasites. So the parasite is actually stuck in a cat. It has to get from one cat to another cat. How does it do that? It doesn't have legs of its own. And it uses rats and mice and other intermediate hosts to actually ferry itself, to kind of taxi from one cat to the other cat. And what we think is happening is that it's getting into the brain of these rats and somehow making it such that that individual rat is more likely to then get eaten by the cat, which passes on the parasite. And my work has shown, when I looked in the brains of the rats that had this parasite and exposed them to a cat, it actually looked similar to when we took an uninfected animal, uninfected male rat, and exposed it to a female rat. Well, one possibility is that you're making them less afraid of the cat, and another possibility is that you're actually making them attracted to the cat. So what I showed is that maybe there's some hint that what's actually happening is this parasite is making these rats actually attracted to the smell of cats.
Which then makes them prey.
Which then makes them spend more time where cats are, which then makes them more likely to get eaten. I mean, there's a very good reason that rats are, rats and mice alike, anything that a cat, you know, predates, is quite afraid of the smell of a cat because it means imminent doom.
This really does raise the question whether or not we have free will. There's certainly the evolutionary aspect anyway, certain programming, but now we're talking about microorganisms having effect over animal behavior. This particular parasite, Patrickhouse, that you've been studying is also present in people. What's the scope of the presence and how does it affect people that we know of?
Estimates are maybe a fifth to a third of the world, entire world, all six, seven, I don't know how many there are anymore, 6 or 7 billion people. So it is one of definitely the most common parasites in the world. And you might then ask, if you're getting into numbers that large, at what point we can even really figure out what, if anything, this parasite's doing. So people mostly get it, we believe, through eating raw meat. The parasite ends up in a lot of different animals, a lot of different mammals, including cows, sheep, pigs, goats, everything that we eat. And in countries that seem to eat more raw meat, you tend to get higher infection rates. So France and Brazil, steak tartare, Brazilian barbecues, things like that, you actually have some of the highest rates in the world in these two countries. Another possible route is through cat ownership. So the parasite is actually transmitted through the cat poop. If you clean your litter box well and don't clean your hands well afterwards, people can often ingest it that way. We definitely know that people have it in their brains. And the question is, what, if anything, is it doing? So even if we know that it's changing rat behavior, that gives us no certain indicator that it's changing human behavior, because our brains are, they're similar in some respects, but they're very, very different in many. One of the interesting things is, well, you have the parasite sitting in a rat brain for maybe a few months, maybe a few years. They don't live very long. But when you have it in a human, and you have it in a human for decades, is it possible that something is coming out, some perturbation is happening that is just very difficult to recognize? So we really don't know. I mean, if you go into a doctor's office and you have toxoplasma, just the parasite, you just test for the parasite and you do have it, you can do a blood test and they'll tell you. That doctor will do nothing special for you. You are not considered sick. There's no, that's not a disease in and of itself. So right now, clinically, there's no consequence to having the parasite.
One of the illnesses that I saw had a correlation with this particular toxoplasma was schizophrenia.
Yes.
Do we know if the correlation means anything yet?
I want to make two caveats to what I just said, which is that it is very dangerous in two cases. One being if you're immunocompromised. So in HIV patients, for example, which is one way that a human can become immunocompromised, toxoplasmosis, which is the actual clinical version, can be fatal. In addition, it can be very, very bad for fetuses. If a pregnant woman picks up the parasite for the first time, the same way that the parasite gets into our brain, it can actually get into the baby's brain. So there are circumstances. I didn't mean to say that it was just a harmless parasite. As to the kind of correlations with mental illness. So this is one of the most, I think, one of the most interesting things about this, and really the reason I'm studying it. And What I would say is that we know, for instance, for just with schizophrenia, that there are people with schizophrenia that do not have this parasite, and there are people with this parasite that do not have schizophrenia. So it's not a one-to-one link. By no means will it turn out. I mean, many, many more people have the parasite in the world, like I said, maybe up to a third, than do schizophrenia. But it's one of these really tricky things where we don't really know what causes schizophrenia to begin with, and we don't really know what this parasite does. So when you're asking about the correlation between the two, you're really asking to kind of make a link between two things we don't know much about. And it's the kind of strongest link that we have out there is maybe around 50, between 50 and 60 studies now have shown that if you have schizophrenia, you're more likely to have this parasite. That's certainly interesting. Like, that's the first nugget of, you know, how scientific hypotheses develop. And now we have to investigate that further. But it's quite likely that actually what could happen, maybe, just as an example, people with schizophrenia tend to have poor hygiene, tend to take less good care of themselves. And that could actually lend to maybe undercooking your meat or not washing your hands, or, you know, you could... schizophrenia can make you more likely to pick up the parasite.
Let me thank you, Patrick House, and let me also thank Dixon DePommier.
Thank you.
Dixon DePommier is a microbiologist, ecologist, and emeritus professor at Columbia University. His books include The Vertical Farm, Feeding the World in the 21st Century, and People, Parasites, and Plowshares, Learning from Our Body's Most Terrifying Invaders. Patrick House is a neuroscientist at Stanford University and the author of a key paper about how one parasite makes rodents lose their fear of cats. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Anais Amin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.